Hi, good to be here with you. Okay, what I want you to do is reach into your purses or your pockets or your back, your jeans, wherever they are, and pull out your cell phone. Okay? And don't turn it off. I thought you saw it, right? You thought I was going to tell you to turn it off? You don't have to turn it off, because we're happy if you are sending messages to your friends. And if you were texting, and if you were Twittering, and if you were Facebooking, as long as you're doing it about this conference, okay? All right? As a matter of fact, Moody, who has sponsored the conference and has provided you with all the Girls Gone Wise books for free, yay, Moody! Woo-hoo-hoo! All girls love to get stuff free. Okay, and they put together a really, really nice Girls Gone Wise basket with all kinds of goodies in it, books in it, Girls Gone Wise bags, Girls Gone Wise coffee mugs, are the coolest things ever, and Girls Gone Wise buttons, and they're gonna do a draw of all the tweets and Twitters and Facebook updates and likes and yada, 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 all that social networking, stalking stuff. To give away that great prize. So go ahead, okay? It's like at Girls Gone Wise or W Conference is the Twitter, or look it up or do it. But I want you to be listening as you're doing that. And I will ask you to turn your cell phones off later on in the evening. But for right now, go ahead. Social network yourselves. Get it out of your system. You don't have to sneak. You can hold it up and go like that, okay? If you want to snap a picture, snap it and post it. We're okay with that. Now, when have you been to church when they've said that? This is good. This is all good. We're going to have a look all this weekend and talk about what it means to be wise in a world gone wild. Because really, our world has gone wild, has it not? And it takes a lot of gumption to know how to live as a wise woman with all the cultural pressures that are on us. There was a song in 1966 published by the Troggs, for those of you who happen to be around in that era. Hey, girlfriends, who was around in the 60s? Oh, yeah. All right, I just celebrated my big 5-0, all right? Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo! So, happy birthday, Mary, right? November 11th. I didn't get cards from too many of you. I'm really concerned about that. But I was born in 1960. 1966, there was a song that came out and has popularized several times since then, Wild Thing. You know it? Okay. Okay, let's do the air guitar thing. Okay, it goes, bum, 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 and it goes, Wild Thing. Okay, we're not very rockish, are we? You make my heart sing, bum, bum, bum. You make everything, bum, bum, bum. Groovy. All right. And those of you who were born after the 60s are going, these women are nuts, right? These women are nuts. But really, that was the message. That Wild Thing, you make my heart sing, you make everything groovy. And I had a dress, something like that. Isn't that scary? So in the 1960s, the Girl Gone Wild was the bell-bottomed hippie girl, and she was flower-powered and peacenik, and she hooked up in the back of a Volkswagen van, and that was what she did. But really, that wasn't the first time in history that girls had gone wild. If you roll the tape back a little bit, you see that the Girl Gone Wise of the 20s, this is your grandmas you're looking at, was the flapper. And she smoked and she drank and she danced and she had a giddy, risque attitude, and she wore makeup and long necklaces and feathers and fur, and she hung out in jazz clubs, and she openly rejected the prohibition laws, and she went to petting parties. She was just wild. And then we have the Gibson girl. You rewind the tape even more. She was the wild thing at the turn of the 19th century. She was the bad girl who crossed all the boundaries of propriety, and she wore clothing that was unencumbered by bustles or layers, and she piled her hair up on her head and let a couple tendrils hang down, and her loose clothing signified a loosened up sexual attitude and sexual standard. Clergymen in the 18th century publicly wrote and took a stand against the décolleté, all right, the plunging neckline that characterized the wild thing of that era. And not only did her neckline scoop down to the lowest possible level, she wore the S-bend corset, the fashion accessory of that day, which basically forced her bust forward and her butt back and narrowed her waist to a scant 20 inches. Ouch, ouch. Can you imagine how much that hurt? Okay, the wild thing, we go even further back, of the 1600s. She absolutely shocked the world with her outrageous behavior when she and the girls started having their boudoir portraits painted in a state of undress. Shocking, all right? Shocking in that century. And that was written about as well. And it was really that generation's equivalent of the girls gone wild of today who expose themselves for porn videos or who sex message naked images of themselves and send them around the school or who post provocative pictures on Facebook. Now, some of you may be thinking, oh, you know, wild things are just those who follow, yeah, it's just those girls that follow the cutting edge of fashion, or that's those who are in danger of going wild, or maybe you're thinking it's just the women who push the edge on what's considered culturally acceptable at any given point in time throughout history. Or you might be thinking that since you aren't risque or promiscuous, that you aren't wild. It's that kind of woman that's gone wild and not you. But I think you will soon see, and you'll see over the course of the weekend, that wildness is really something that affects all of us. And I'll never forget being at a conference. It was a true woman conference, and I did a workshop, and there was an old lady that came up to me afterwards, although 70 isn't looking all that old at this point in time. She was 70, and she came up, and she was crying, and she said, you know, I came to get some information on how to help my granddaughter, but I see now that it's me who's a girl gone wild. All right, at 70, that she made that realization. So, girls gone wild, we're going to talk about three things in this particular session. I want to talk to you about what wildness is all about. Really, at root, what is wildness all about? Is it just the way we dress, or, you know, what constitutes wildness? And then I'm going to take a rewind through just the past few decades of women's history, because I think that there has been an influence in our culture and where we are at this point in time in culture, that there has been an influence of all of us to think as a wild woman, to go wild in our thoughts and then also in our behavior. And then I want to end this session, and before we go into the next session, just on the question of why you need to be intentional about being wise and not wild. Now, how many of you have ever watched that show, What Not to Wear? All right, Stacy and Clinton, right? They are in that show. Last weekend, we spooled it up at our house, and my daughter-in-law was over, so Jacqueline and I were sitting there watching What Not to Wear. And, of course, What Not to Wear, for those of you who aren't familiar with the show, Stacy and Clinton prowl around, they find people who are dressing wildly, who are ugly or frumpy or mismatched or racy and provocative. And generally, they encounter two types of responses in these people, those who welcome their input and those who really don't. And last weekend was the episode where they did the, like, wildest, weirdest, most difficult people that they have ever dealt with on What Not to Wear. So Jacqueline and I were sitting there watching this, and there was a 36-year-old woman, and she was dressing... And she was a mom, and she was really dressing very, very provocatively. And she wore skin-tight, shiny leotards and cat suits, and she kept telling them, I'm working it. I'm working it. And she thought that she looked good, but she didn't. She looked very, very cheap. And she really should not have been wearing it. It was age inappropriate. And not only was it age inappropriate, it just did not look good. There are some things that, you know, that should not be worn at all. But what was interesting to me as we were watching is just how resistant she was. She was so resistant to their input. She kept telling them, I look good. I look good. I know what I look good in. And they're just going, no, honey, you don't. And at one point, Clinton, just in exasperation, said, do you watch our show? And she says, well, yeah. And he says, do you think that we know what we're talking about? And she's, well, she didn't quite answer that one. And then he says, do you think that we're experts? And finally she said, well, maybe you know a little bit. And it was just the whole thing. It wasn't even so much the way she dressed. It was her attitude. It was the attitude that she had and the attitude of, I don't need you. I know better than you. I'm doing fine without your input. Thank you very much. I don't need you. Excuse me. And the show revealed that it wasn't even so much her appearance that was the problem. It was her attitude. And it's interesting that as they spooled through these, you know, worst of the worst, that it was the same sort of attitude that showed up even in the girls that dressed frumpy and ugly. It was that, I don't need guidance. I'm not going to trust the what not to wear experts. I will judge for myself what looks good on me. And it seems to me that there is a similar attitude that really lies at the core of wild behavior. Excuse me, I'm going to take a drink of water here. You can all, like, Twitter, Mary's taking a drink of water. Mary's finished her water now and is clearing her throat. At Mary Cassian at Girls Gone Wise, W Conference. Okay. So the Bible doesn't really give us a list. It doesn't give us a list of specific behaviors when it comes to wildness. It doesn't give us a list that, oh, your skirt should not be more than 4 hand breadths above your knee. Okay, that was my mom's rule. Okay, and that is actually shocking to me. That was her rule for my hot pants. Okay, so I had to go 1, 2, 3, 4, and if it was shorter than that, I couldn't wear it. Okay, I'm thinking, man, I wouldn't let my daughter run around like that. But anyway, that was, and I have no idea how she came up with that 4 hand breadth rule. I mean, I'm pretty tall. I got a lot of thigh, so I mean, I probably have about 16 hand breadths from my knee to my hip. But it's just, that was her rule. And then, but the Bible doesn't give us a, you know, 4 hand breadths above the knee rule. And oh, check, I got that one right. Or no spaghetti strap shirt. Oh, check, got that one right. No cleavage. Oh, see, I got my, that's good. No cleavage, check. Okay, or how about, oh, you can't kiss the guy you're dating for more than 3 minutes without coming up for air. Check, all right. Or how about no romance novels? Check. Or I clean the toilet, he cleans the car. Check. All right. It doesn't give us a list like that. It doesn't give us a detailed list so that we can check off all the boxes and be proud of the fact that we're not wild. It just doesn't do that. Because wildness cannot be contained on a checklist. And the reason it can't be contained on a checklist is it because it's a matter of the heart. Is what it boils down to. Do you think that if we gave all the girls exposing themselves on all the wild things exposing themselves on the beaches nowadays a checklist about what they should wear and what they should and shouldn't do, that their hearts would cease to be wild? Do you think that would work? No, it wouldn't work. So according to the Bible, wildness is much more than breaking a set of rules, all right? Wildness shows up in behavior, it definitely does. But wildness is a problem of the heart. Wildness is actually a heart attitude that disregards God. It's having that attitude, I will do it my way. I'll do it my way. And if a girl is wild, it's her attitude that's the problem, And that's at the core of the problem. It's not just her behavior. I'm wild whenever I discount God as a factor in shaping the way I live, when I conclude that I don't need Him, when I put Him on the shelf and think that He's not necessary, when I treat God as inconsequential, when I exclude Him, when I leave Him out, when I claim the right to define myself and I think that I can do what I want, when I think I'm in charge, I'm the one who knows best, when I rely on what I think is right in my own eyes or what the world is telling me, somebody else's advice to determine the way that I'll live. So wildness is whatever is when I don't trust the expert. It's when I don't rely on the expert and when I don't bring the expert, the Lord, into the equation. And that was the mistake of our mother, the first girl gone wild, Eve, who went with her own gut instinct instead of listening to the Lord. She followed Satan's advice instead of trusting and obeying the Lord. And she fell for his deceitful sales pitch. So if you have your Bibles, you can just flip over to that passage. Genesis chapter 3, verses 1 to 5. Genesis chapter 3, verses 1 to 5. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Did God actually say you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?" Okay, so here he starts by saying, you know what? God is like overly restrictive. He's like trying to rain on your party. Are you kidding me? Did he actually say that? You gotta be kidding. Did God actually say? I don't think God knows what he's talking about. All right? So this is what the serpent's saying. And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." But the serpent said to the woman, "You will surely not die." Oh, you know, you're not going to suffer negative consequences by detouring from God's plan. It's not going to be bad for you. You're not going to die, all right? You're not going to die. And then it continues, "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So he tempted her with thinking that God was holding out on her, that he was keeping her from reaching her full potential, that she shouldn't let herself be denied, that when you do it, take hold of that which looks so beautiful and right and good, you're going to be like God. And so he fed her this line. And Eve fell into the trap of thinking that she had the right to judge the merits of the fruit apart from God's input, that she had the smarts to figure out the best thing to do. And then we see the passage continues that when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. So from her perspective, the fruit looked groovy. All right? It looked great. It looked attractive. It was a delight to the eyes. And it looked harmless. It was good for food. And it looked so incredibly promising. It was desired to make one wise. She says, hey, wildness, just, you know, not putting God into the equation, just deciding for myself, it's going to make my heart sing. And it's going to make everything groovy, all right? And so she bit, and she bit into the fruit. And how many times have you watched your friends fall into that trap of thinking that sin is attractive, that sin is harmless, and that sin is promising, and that if they just go that way, they're going to be happy? And they swallow the whole idea that they have the capacity to make good choices apart from God. How many of you times have you watched your friends fall into that? How many times have you fallen for that? I've fallen for that. Thinking that it just looks so good and so attractive, and I have the smarts to figure it out, and I know I'm going to decide how I'm going to live, and I don't need to listen to the Lord. I'm wild whenever I am too obstinate, or too proud, or I am too naive, too simple, or too busy, or too lackadaisical, or too weak-willed. We don't want weak-willed women, do we? No, no, no. Lord doesn't want weak-willed women. Or too foolish to do things God's way. That's when I'm wild. I'm wild when I leave God out of the picture and make up my own rules and set my own standards and think that I have the right to decide for myself what's good for me and what my life is all about. And that was the core attitude of the wild thing, Lady Babylon. And if you have, flip over to Isaiah 47, verses 7 to 8. This was her attitude. You said, I shall be mistress forever, so that you did not lay these things to heart or remember their end. Now therefore hear this, you lover of pleasures, who sit securely, who say in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. Okay, and if you're into underline, you can underline that word, that little phrase right there, I am, and there is no one besides me, because that's the nub of wildness right there. That's what wildness is. In other words, I'll do it my way. I have the right to decide for myself. No one has the right to tell me what to do. I define who I am. And here's how the passage reads in the paraphrase, the message. It says, you said, I'm the first lady. I'll always be the pampered darling. You never took anything seriously, took nothing to heart. You never gave tomorrow a thought. Well, start thinking, playgirl. You're acting like the center of the universe, smugly saying to yourself, I'm number one. There's no one but me. You thought you knew so much and had everything figured out. What delusion, telling yourself, smugly telling yourself, I'm number one. There's no one but me. And then if you flip over back a few pages to Isaiah chapter 3, verses 16 to 24, you see the same sort of attitude showing up in God's daughters, and that they had gone wild. It's really, when you read through this whole passage, you look at verse 16, and it says that the daughters of Zion are haughty. Okay, they've got an attitude, and they are walking with outstretched necks. Pride, I got it all together. They're glancing wantonly with their eyes. Okay, wanton, we're not talking about dumplings in the soup, right? Wanton, we're talking about that. You know what that is. It's the come get me look, all right? And every woman in this room knows about the come get me look, all right? So these girls, his daughters, were walking around with the come get me look. Not only that, they had the body language. They were mincing along as they went, all right? Trying to garnish male sexual attention, trying to walk provocatively. And they had... And then the Lord passes judgment of this, and it says, you know what? And you look down, you see that they had, they were all into how they looked, how they smelled. They had perfume and belts and ropes and well-set hair and rich robes and skirts. And they had all sorts of jewelry, headdresses, scarves, amulets, sashes, perfume boxes. You know, they knew how to go down to Mac and pick up the right colors. Knew how to put the smoky eye look together. Okay, these girls had it going on. I'm working it. That was their attitude. And so their wildness showed up in the way that they did life as women. And so you see that God's daughters had gone wild in this whole attitude of I have the right to determine how I live and what my life is all about and what my womanhood is all about. And I don't need God. I don't need Him telling me what to do. It's all about me. I'm the best judge attitude. I'm not going to concern myself with what God thinks. And that was at the heart of Eve's wildness. It's at the heart of Lady Babylon's wildness. It was at the heart of the wildness of the daughter of Zion, and it's at the heart of the wildness of every wild thing that's gone wild throughout history. Disregarding God and setting my own course is essentially what wildness is all about. Okay, so the second thing that I want to talk about is I want to give you just a real quick overview of history, and I'm going to just show you just how profoundly our recent history has affected us with that whole attitude that we have the right to decide what our lives are all about. The woman's movement, what we've seen in the last several decades, has contributed to an attitude amongst women that we've got it figured out. We've got the smarts. We know how to live life. And I think that women in the past 60 years specifically have been targeted by the evil one and trained to think that wildness is groovy and that self-determination is desirable and promising and that we're going to be happy when we claim the right to determine our own destiny and to decide what womanhood is all about. I'm going to give you a real quick overview of history because it's really important to think about where you get your ideas about womanhood. Now, a lot of you here are younger than I am, much younger than I am. I could be your mom. Wouldn't that be fun? I love having a girl. I got my first daughter, and we have a blast. But you haven't experienced all of woman's history in the last 50, 60 years. And there's actually been a profound shift. And those of us who have lived through it have seen a profound shift in worldview and thinking amongst women. Now, having said that, I just need to draw your attention to the fact that Barbara Billingsley passed away last month. Now, how many of you care? How many of you know who Barbara Billingsley is? Okay, about... And how many of you who know who Barbara Billingsley are my age? Okay, Barbara Billingsley. Yeah, what do I care? Who's Barbara Billingsley? What? All right, Barbara Billingsley was an actress. All right, and she's best known for portraying, I know who Barbara is. She's best known for portraying the quintessential suburban American mom in the late 1950s television comedy, Leave It to Beaver. Has anybody watched that ever? It's kind of making a comeback, right? Beaver was quirky, he was fun, it was cute. But anyway, in her signature role as June Cleaver, she personified that era's definition of the ideal woman. And at that time, society believed that the ideal woman was a happy stay-at-wife, housewife, and mom, which was a reaction in no small part to what had happened a decade earlier in World War II. Because during the war, women had to go out to the workforce. Men weren't around. They had to go to war. And marriage and family life was put on hold, and it was severely disrupted due to the absence of men. And then the fact that many men were killed at that time in the war, and not that many came home, when they did come home, all that the women wanted to do was to settle down and get married and have families and nest and enjoy the family life and the peace and the stability that war had denied them. And technology also changed at that time. Technology and production shifted its focus from wartime efforts to the home front. So all of the brain power and the innovations and the technological advances and the factories responsible for creating bombs and military goods during the war had to find new things to do when the war ended. So they began to create and market all sorts of new electronic and household goods. So during the war, they produced airplanes. And after the war, glory be, they produced appliances. Yay, appliances. So big appliance companies like GE started making and marketing all sorts of electric appliances. There was just boom, this big technical innovation. So you had vacuum cleaners and electric stoves and electric washers and dryers, which was just an absolutely amazing thing. I remember my mom still had one of those crank washers, and where she had to take the sopping wet clothes. It's called a wringer washer. Anybody remember what that is? Yeah, all three of you who are my age, all right. Where it had a couple rollers, and you kind of put, like, took the wet sopping clothes, and you kind of got it started in between these rollers, and then you went, and it came out the other end, like, literally, it came in like this and came out like this, like, flat like a pancake. You shook it out and hung it up. And it was a lot of work getting clothes clean. So I remember that my mom thought that she had died and gone to heaven when she got an electric washing machine. It was just like, she was like dancing when the Sears appliance men came and the electric washer was delivered. So there were electric can openers and irons and waffle irons and blenders and McMasters and microwave ovens and toasters and polyester clothes. They never had to be ironed. And some of you older ladies are going, oh, glory be. Why did our men ever trade those polyester suits in, right? Or maybe not. They're pretty bad, maybe not. But these conveniences saved an enormous amount of time and made women's life a lot easier. And another factor that greatly influenced culture was the advent of television. In 1950, less than 10% of TV homes had TVs. By the end of that decade, it was virtually all of them, 90% of homes. And advertisers started using this medium to pump the message of home life and what life as a woman was all about. And advertisers in the 1950s exalted the home and the homemaker and all the appliances that would make women's life easier and better. So, she was inundated with the idea that in order to be truly happy, in order to be truly fulfilled as a woman, she needed to whip up a cake in her General Electric with her General Electric Mixmaster and bake it in her General Electric oven and cut it with her General Electric knife and serve it to her family who were watching their new Zenith TV. And they're sitting there in a living room that had been vacuumed with the new and easy Hoover vacuum cleaner. And then she could get out her clothes and get all the stains out of the clothing in her super duper nifty General Electric washer and dryer. So taking care of her house, enjoying these new fandangled appliances, having a station wagon full of kids and a house with a white picket fence, and taking pride in having a bathtub that did not have a ring, was upheld as the formula for women's happiness. And the poster child consumer for all these new products on the market was the happy stay-at-home housewife. And it's also important to note that at that time there was still a widespread societal commitment to Judeo-Christian values. And I remember coming out of a culture like that. It was like almost everybody got married. Girls got married out of high school sometimes. The average age for getting married was 20 years old for girls and 22 years old for guys. So they were married by the time everybody was married. Everybody got married. Wedding rings everywhere. Divorce was highly frowned upon. The divorce rate was fairly low. Chastity, virginity were highly valued virtues. Sex outside of marriage was shameful. You didn't talk about it. You didn't want anybody to know if you did it because it was just shameful. Scarcely anybody lived common law. So few couples lived together before marriage that statistics for this phenomena were not even recorded prior to my lifetime. Having a child outside of wedlock was all considered shameful. Single unwed moms were extremely rare. Only 30% of women were employed outside of the home, and you weren't usually employed outside of the home. There were very, very few that were employed outside of the home if you had kids who had not yet started school. If you had preschool kids, you stayed at home with your kids. There's no birth control pill prior to the early 60s. Abortion was illegal. Pornography and rape and homosexuality and sexual perversion and sexual addiction, sexually transmitted diseases, they were around, but they were relatively uncommon. You didn't encounter it that often. Men regarded it as their responsibility to protect and provide for the women. Women regarded it as their responsibility to ensure that the home front was in order so that they could promote and enjoy a happy family life and support their husbands and focus on raising children in a stable and a nurturing and a loving environment. And their professional careers and their took secondary status to their primary career of raising and nurturing their next generation. Although not everybody's life looked like Leave It to Beaver, and many lives didn't, many didn't, it was kind of upheld as, this is great, this is the way it should be, this is the wonderful way. And society pumped the message that following this checklist for womanhood would make women happy. But there was an American journalist that started writing at that time and started noticing that not all women were happy, that there were many housewives who were not happy housewives, that they had feelings of discontent, that the formula, the checklist that they had been given wasn't bringing about the fulfillment that they so desperately wanted to. And according to Betty Friedan, at that time, who wrote the book of Feminine Mystique, there was a big problem in the world. And the problem was that man had dictated what womanhood was all about. Man had kept woman in this state of servitude, in this role, in this state of service, and in the role of housewife, wife, and mom. And that he did that, historically, he did that to serve his own selfish agenda, so he could clap his hands and have his dinner brought and his slippers brought, and that was man's selfishness that had defined this. Friedan and her ideological mentor, who was the French philosopher Simone de Beauvoir, believed that in order for women to be happy, we needed to demand our rights and collectively rebel against man and overthrow all of these societal structures that men had constructed to keep women in the oppressed second-sex role. They wanted to get women angry against men and to get them to rebel against the traditional role of womanhood. Simone de Beauvoir specifically postulated that in order to gain equality with men, women needed to get out of the house, they needed to stop putting their husbands and children first, and they needed to intentionally deconstruct Judeo-Christian ideas about marriage and motherhood and morality. That we needed a revolution in gender roles in order for women to be freed and equal. And de Beauvoir and Friedan pushed the idea that woman has the right to name herself. You've got to take power into your own hands and define who you are, set your own standards. Men have taken your power away. It's time for you to grab it back, claim your independence, and grab hold of power for yourself to say what your life is all about. And their ideas set the foundation and formed the basis for the philosophy of feminism. Now, when I use the word feminism, I'm using it in a very specific way. I believe feminism is a distinct philosophy that shook the underpinnings of society through a few decades, really from the 1960s to the 1990s, and most specifically in the 1970s. And like atheism and humanism and Marxism and existentialism and postmodernism, feminism is an ism, okay? And when you hear that ism, it means that there's really a distinct set of ideas that were proposed. So when I'm talking about feminism, feminism encompasses so much more than just the cultural phenomena of women getting the right to vote, or more than women having the right to own property, or women getting an education, or having a job or a career, or women being treated with dignity and respect. That's not what feminism is. Certainly that was surrounding it. But feminism is a philosophy, and it's an ideology, and it's a way of thinking, and it's a way of viewing the world. And it's a distinct worldview with its own ideologies and values and ways of thinking. And the core idea of feminism is that women have the inherent and power and right to dictate what the world should look like. That's the core idea. And whether or not you know it, or whether or not you would care to admit it, many of you girls sitting here are going, feminism, that's yesterday's news. Like, that's like that hippie dress. I'm not a feminist. But I would say that feminism has profoundly affected each and every woman living today in this culture. And the major tenets of this philosophy is being embraced and systematically integrated into culture as a whole. We don't even think of feminism anymore. We wouldn't even call it that anymore. We wouldn't even call those ideas feministic anymore, because feminism has just become the way that all of us think. It's been mainstreamed. So here are a few quotes from feminist thinkers, from feminist writers. I'm just going to run through these quotes real quick that just summarize their ideology, okay? Feminism's ideology. Patriarchy is the power of the fathers, the system in which men determine what part women shall or shall not play, and which the female is everywhere put under the male. Women are imprisoned by the roles of wife and mother. all forms of wrestling women away from these roles favor her liberation. Unless revolution disturbs the basic societal organization of the family, which is the tapeworm of exploitation, will never be annihilated. Here's another one. With feminism, women find themselves living in a new space centered in the lives of women. They reclaim the right to speak, to name the self, the world, the meaning of their own existence. Another one, the end goal of the feminist revolution is not just the elimination of male privilege, but of sex distinction itself. This movement, feminism, is a reclaiming of the right to name. It's a reclaiming of the right to name, of women claiming the right to name the self, world, and God. And Betty Friedan summed up the whole philosophy quite well, I think, when she said, "We women need and can trust no other authority than our own personal truth." Okay? That's feminism. That's what I mean by a distinct philosophy. And it gripped women at that time, and it was a huge ideological shift. Up until that time, it was generally thought that the roles of men and women were based on the natural order of things, or that God had something to do with it. And there was this shift, and feminism started proclaiming that women had the right to decide what being a woman was all about. They argued that all the things that women traditionally upheld as important, marriage, children, home, morality, they aren't all that important, and you should not focus on those things. In fact, those were the very things that were holding women back and squelching their potential. And that having a career and money and power and independence and sexual freedom were of far more worth and value. And that was the secret ingredients for women's happiness. So in 1968, feminists staged a big protest at the Miss America pageant. They set up the Freedom Trash Can, and they essentially said, "We need to trash the traditional definition of womanhood." This is where the term bra burners came from. They threw away the bras, they threw away the ladies' home magazines, they threw away the cookbooks, they threw away all those things that they called instruments of female oppression. That men had used these things to oppress women. They trashed the definition and they said, "We have got to redefine who we are. We need to get out into the workforce. We need to begin to live our lives for us and to put ourselves first." And if you're interested in more of that history, I would suggest that you read either The Feminist Mistake that I've written or a book by Carolyn McCulley called Radical Womanhood. I'll give you a whole lot more insight into that. Those of you who lived through it remember some of these things. Do you remember it? Do you remember 1972? Okay, since we're in the singing mood, what is it? "I am strong, strong. I am invincible, invincible. I am woman." I don't know how they got all those weird notes in there. But anyway, by the late 1960s, the image of June Cleaver being happy at home had fallen by the wayside, and it was replaced by the 1970s Mary Tyler Moore image of a perky single woman in her early 30s who was pursuing a career, and she didn't need a guy. Mary Tyler Moore was single, she was on the pill, but the focus of the show was her career, not on her association with men. She didn't need a guy, she was independent, she didn't need to be defined by a man. And the theme song of that, for you girls, "You're gonna make it after all." Okay, there's enough of you here that, like, are my age. Alright? The whole thought that women can be disassociated from man, independent of man, and be her own woman. Murphy Brown in the 1980s. So the news anchor for the fictional FYI, fictional TV news magazine. So in contrast to the gentle sweetness of Mary, you saw Murphy Brown, and she's loudmouthed, and she's brash, and she's driven, and self-assured, and self-absorbed. She's a divorcee, she's an atheist. And then during the course of the series, what happens? She gets pregnant, right? And then, horror of horrors, and this was a huge cultural shakeup. Do you remember what happened? She decided to have the baby and keep the baby out of wedlock and become a single mom. So it's not that long ago. it was outrageous. And in fact, wasn't a vice president that got in trouble for saying something about that? Who was that? Dan Quayle, right, okay, bless his heart. He got in trouble for that. And so this child was just merely the side plot in, you know, I really like that phrase. I'm a northern girl, and I don't know what it means. I think it just kind of means anything, doesn't it? Bless her heart. Bless his heart. I just kind of learning how to slip it in there. I really ought to teach you girls how to say, how's it going, eh? All right, that would be a Canadian thing. But anyway, on we go. So, in the mid-90s, enter Ellen, who is the woman who owns her own independent bookstore. Ellen lives with a guy, but she's not involved with him, and the relationship is platonic. She's not sexually attracted to him, and as the series goes on, we find out that Ellen is attracted to men at all, right? She's attracted to women. She's a lesbian. She's a woman-identified woman, and if you go historically, lesbianism was really a badge of honor for many women because they said, I am truly independent when I don't have a man defining me. And so I'm going to be a woman-identified woman and identify myself from, distance myself from heterosexuality and from men. So she has a right to define her own sexuality and her own morality, and no one has the right to judge her for it. She is out and she is in charge. And virtually all the women that we see in the media in the past decade are in charge, right? From children's cartoons to television series to movies, women are now portrayed as having an in charge, you know, kick the bottom, don't need a guy, I'm powerful, traditional family and marriage, that's not what my notes said, but I changed it. Marriage and family and morals are outdated. I have the right to decide. I have the right to do what I want, that kind of mentality. And in the past couple decades, we've been inundated with the message that when it comes to relationships, women can make their own rules. They can sleep around, they can hook up, they can be in casual or long-term relationships, they can live common law, they can get married or remain single, divorced, pregnant, have a baby. Being married is inconsequential. They can abort a baby because it's their bodies. They can do what they want. They can have men as roommates or as playthings. Have sex with men or with women, and they can be cougars. They can do virtually anything that they want, any type of behavior they choose. And the sitcom Friends was based on this premise that there's so many different equally valid options that a woman can choose all these different things. And as long as she's nice, she really has the right to determine for herself what her life is about. And then Sex and the City, which said, all right, if I have the right to take power into my own hands, well, sexuality is power. What's more powerful in a woman's life than her sexuality? So I'm going to flaunt my sexuality and use it, and use my sexuality to get what I want and to be what I want. And as long as women are loyal to themselves, they can do that. They can be loud and arrogant and vulgar and crude and crass and use their sexuality as power. So in this new worldview, we went through a class today and I had all the girls come up with a new worldview of what men are. And what are men? Well, they're whiny. They're not too bright. They're kind of stupid. They're totally unreliable. And it was really interesting. We put together this list, and at break time, a guy walked into the room and he was reading the list and he looked at me and he said, yeah, that pretty much sums it up. That pretty much sums it up, how we are portrayed and how what I have to deal with every day about what women think about me. Daughters, and our daughters, and you women of the new generation have been intentionally taught to think with a feminist mindset. In the 1970s, the golden age of feminism, there was millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of government dollars that were pushed into this whole concept that we need to change what womanhood is all about. Textbooks were rewritten. They were purged of images of motherhood being a good thing, or of women nurturing, being a housewife and nurturing their kids. Purged. Your grade oneers weren't allowed to read about that anymore because that is so oppressive of women. Language was changed. Textbooks were changed. Curriculum was changed. Television programs were changed. In the 1970s, there went from there being zero women's studies courses to being over 30,000 women's studies courses in the course of 10 years. It was phenomenal, just this tsunami change in worldview and in the lives of women in the course of my lifetime, and I don't think I'm very old. In fact, I think I'm younger all the time. And if you girls think that you haven't been influenced by it, or that this ideology is not everywhere, I just want you to consider, what's that top image? That's from the Powerpuff Girls cartoon. This is what your wee little ones watch on Saturday mornings. Well, guess who's the ultimate evil? Okay, he's the red guy there that looks like a cross-dresser. What's his name? Him. That's his name. Him. He's the ultimate evil. And he creates the ultimate villains, which are what? The rowdy rough boys. The rowdy rough boys are him's creation. He creates these rowdy rough boys, the ultimate, the evil villains that these gritty rough boys. The rowdy rough boys are him's creation. He creates these rowdy rough boys, the ultimate, the evil villains that these girls, Powerpuff Girls, need to overcome. And I'm walking out of view of the story. I'm back. The rowdy rough boys need to overcome. And there's these rowdy rough boys are really, really big. Well, guess how these Powerpuff Girls tame them? With their kisses. They give them a kiss. And they tame them, and they control their behavior. And then when the rowdy rough boys don't respond to their kisses anymore, the girls come up with a new strategy, and it's very, very effective. You know what their new strategy is? They insult them, and they cut them down, and they mock them and belittle them as men. And each time they do that, the rowdy rough boys get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. They cut them down to size. This is what our daughters are being raised on. Or the Sesame Street, all about girl power. I used to think that sewing was so nice, but now I'm enlightened. Now I sew up people instead. Right? Women can be doctors and lawyers, and yes, they can be. I don't deny that. I have a professional degree in rehab medicine. I'm not denying that, but I'm saying that the message that we are teaching our young daughters is that everything a woman can do is more important than family and children and marriage. And that you only do those things, those nurturing kinds of things, if you think it's going to self-actualize you as a woman. So I want you to be clear about what I'm saying and not saying. I'm not saying that we should go back to Leave It to Beaver. That was then, this is now. The 50s is not the cookie cutter formula for women. Women's happiness doesn't come from following a checklist. It comes from having a right relationship with Jesus Christ and recognizing His authority in our lives. And I'm not saying that all the issues that feminism raised with regards to problems in male-female relationships are invalid, or that the attitudes and the sin of man ought not to be confronted. I'm not saying that. It breaks my heart, and I become angry when I see sin and how women are sometimes treated and degraded. It's deplorable. It breaks the heart of God. I'm not saying that feminism didn't address some legitimate questions and concerns. I think that it raised the right question, but it didn't come up with the right answer. What I am saying is that we're living in a time in history when there's been a tremendous upheaval in the definition of womanhood. And we're living in a period in history when wildness, when an attitude of wildness has been normalized. And not only normalized, but the essence of womanhood is now defined as wildness. It used to be that wildness was deviance. And now wildness is normative. That attitude. And the wild attitude, I think some of the feminists would turn in their graves if they saw what the attitude that they introduced, how the next generation is taking that and running with that. You know, the bra burners that got rid of their bras and all of those things. would be horrified and protested at the Miss America pageant, would be horrified to see that the daughters have really turned to a raunch culture and embraced really a porn raunch culture and have done so under the banner of having the right to choose for themselves, which is the core essence of feminist philosophy. Virtually everything in culture at this point in history is geared towards getting women to go wild. So we've talked about what wildness is all about and how contemporary culture has influenced us. And in the next session, we're going to be having a look at a story of Wild Thing in Scripture and see some specific ways. But I just want to close this session off just with this thought. Now, we have been taught that we ought not to bow and submit to any external power, but that is not the message of the Bible, ladies. That is not the message of the Bible. God created us, and He created us male and female, and that fact is not inconsequential. That means something. It means something. And the Bible says that there was an essential difference in the manner and in the purpose of the creation of the sexes, and there are basic differences between men and women that need to be honored as part of God's design. And by refusing to honor these differences, or by defiantly shaking our hand at God, our fist at God, and saying, "It cannot be so," we claim a right that does not belong to us. We can't claim a right that only belongs to our Creator. It's God who made the earth and who put us on it and who created mankind and created us male and female. And we have no right to question the wisdom of His directives. God said through Isaiah, "Woe to him who quarrels with his maker, to him who is but a potsherd," which is a broken piece of pottery, "among the potsherds on the ground. Does the clay say to the potter, 'What are you making?' Does your work say, 'He has no hands'? Concerning things to come, do you question me or give me orders? It is I who made the earth and created mankind upon it." So He's the potter, and I'm the clay. And how ludicrous to think that a piece of clay would dictate its own shape and purpose. The Creator fashioned the two sexes differently, and that's a fact that we shouldn't overlook and we shouldn't trivialize it. The Bible doesn't provide a checklist stereotype of which sex does what. Okay, it's the guys who clean the car, the guys who do the building, and the women do this, and the guys do this. I'd be in a lot of trouble if that was the case, because I was raised by a carpenter's daughter, and I do the electrical rewiring in my basement. I can swing a hammer much better than my husband. He doesn't know which end to hold. He brings other things, but that's not his gift. It isn't in, it's not about that, all right? It's not about that, but the Bible does teach us distinct principles on how we ought to relate to one another. It teaches us distinct principles on how to know and understand who we are as men and as women. And our identity as a woman, and or a man's identity as a man, has a really important symbolic aspect. It teaches us truths about God, and it teaches us truths about who God is, and displays the glory of His redemptive plan through Christ Jesus. And if we lose these fundamental images, we lose ourselves, and we lose sight of truth. The right to define womanhood belongs to our Creator. He's the potter. Wisdom is found in Jesus Christ, not in my own smarts. Colossians 2:3 says that in Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And Paul goes on to explain in that passage, "I say this in order that no one may delude you with plausible arguments." You see, the messages we get about womanhood from culture just sound so plausible. They sound so good. It looks good. It looks attractive and promising and desirable. And Christ's way is so counterintuitive to the ways of the world. 1 Corinthians 2:14, "The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him. He's not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned." See, the wisdom of the world is folly with God. And when we think that we're smart enough and we leave God out of things, our paths will wander. And so that's why it's so intentional and why we put together this W conference to address these issues. Proverbs 5 and 6 talks about a wild thing. It says, her feet go down to death, her steps follow the wrong path. She does not ponder the way of life. Her ways wander and she does not know it. So she doesn't even know she's going wrong because she doesn't take time to wrestle with the question of what does God say to me? So that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to take a break now. I'm going to pray, dismiss you, and Jay's going to... Actually, I will pray later. Jay, would you just dismiss us and give us some direction? And then when you come back, we're going to open Scripture again and have a look at a little bit more about what it means to be wild and learn how we can live as wise.